For many years now, Peabody Award-winning broadcaster and best-selling author Krista Tippett has been inspiring audiences with her writing and her insightful and thoughtful discussions. Her American Public Media program, On Being, is heard here on St. Louis Public Radio Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock. Krista has written a new book. As usual, the subject is big. The title is Becoming Wise, An Inquiry into the Mystery and Art of Living. In it, she draws and reflects on many of the conversations she has had over the years with some of the world's most respected thinkers. I'm happy to welcome Krista Tippett to this program once again. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, I'm so glad to be back with you.
I know you've got a full schedule today, and I'm looking forward to being with you tonight at the Ethical Society.
Yes.
Before we talk about the book, Krista, I've always been intrigued by the detour that you took from working for the State Department or working with the diplomatic mission in Berlin to suddenly go off in this other direction. What caused you to make that change?
Mm. Well, you know, I found myself at a young age in this amazing geopolitical center, you know, this fault line of the Cold War in the 1980s. It was kind of hard for my kids to take seriously. How big a deal that was.
I'm there with you.
You're there with me. Yeah. You know, a couple of things. I walked into this situation. I was very idealistic. You know, I wanted to change the world. I thought politics was the way to do that. And I ended up kind of partly through forcing myself in places and partly by luck, sort of, you know, eventually sitting around tables with people who were literally moving those nuclear missiles around on the map. And I was aware of this disconnect between the enormity and the importance of what was the work that to be done and kind of the gap between the public personas people had and how also kind of immature and impoverished they could be as human beings.
That hasn't changed much in those years.
Right. Well, I was seeing something. That I continue to see. And then at the same time, divided Berlin was like this great social experiment. You had one people, same language, same history, same culture, divided into two absolutely competing worldviews and economic situations. And I saw in that, I loved people and knew people on both sides of the wall. I was a journalist, so I got around.
Well, you studied in the East Germany.
Yes.
Yeah.
I saw also this classic dynamic of life up close that people created lives of dignity or lives of emptiness, and it was not dependent on the circumstances that were handed to them. That this is work that we take up. And I was especially impressed by, you know, the people I knew in East Germany who had nothing, as we would say, but who created these lives of great intimacy and dignity and beauty. So then I'm in my 20s and I'm thinking, well, what do I want to do with my life? And I was more drawn to that effort and that struggle ultimately than that high level of politics, which was very confusing and contradictory.
Was there an epiphany? Did this happen gradually, or did you wake up one day and say, I've got to change direction?
No, honestly, it was so exhilarating and seductive, that political work I was doing. But I went away. I decided I was going to take a break. I thought I was going back to Washington. I had a plan. Mm-hmm. This was in the summer of 1988. And there was a presidential election upon us, which ended up being a really dismaying presidential election. And boy, that sounds like a familiar experience. I think I was so confused to be drawing these conclusions because I thought I was really on a great fast track to what was really powerful and meaningful. But when I got away and I got quiet and I got rested, that confusion kind of surfaced in me. And then there was it wasn't like one moment, but there was this long process of starting to examine that, starting to ask spiritual questions, which surprised me that I was doing that. Mm-hmm. And then eventually pursuing that and going to divinity school, really not then with a conclusion, but just because I wanted to continue to think this through.
Did you ever regret having left in 88? If you had waited another year, you could have watched the wall come down.
I know. Well, I got back there pretty soon after the wall came down. Actually, those years before 1989 were fascinating in their own way because no one could have foreseen that the world would change so utterly as it did. And that's an important memory for me to know that, to have lived through that where change happened that was unimaginable and happened in a pretty short period of time. But in those years, there was all this ferment. There was, you know, we didn't think that the structures would end, but they were becoming fluid. Things were happening that hadn't happened before. So as somebody who's interested in politics, as much as I'm interested in the human condition, it was a really, really interesting time to be there.
Yeah. And, of course, Angela Merkel, who now is in charge,
was
an East German. And
yeah.
How quickly things have changed.
It's so amazing to me.
How many conversations have you had for your radio programs, do you think?
I think it's something like 400. And actually, one of the things I was happy to do in the back of the book is to list all the conversations.
I didn't count them, but that's why I asked. There are several pages worth of.
Yes.
How have they changed you?
Oh, you know, they've changed me in big ways and small. I certainly, you know, I interview people who have great depth and wisdom and who've really lived lives that make an imprint, and I go away and have so much to think about. And sometimes I get a really practical tool out of an interview. You know, just recently, this one hasn't been on the air yet, but I interviewed this physicist who asks, he's pursuing a question about, does the world embody beautiful ideas? And to have a scientist have me start thinking about beauty and looking for beauty, like that kind of thing is actually, you know, I can immediately carry that with me. But on the other hand, I have to say, Dawn, you know, sometimes people, I think people imagine that I soak in all this wisdom and then I walk through the world. And the truth is, you know, I get up in the morning and I have to make breakfast for my kids and I have that same challenge that we all do to work with the raw materials of my life. And, you know, there are days when my greatest accomplishment has been getting the recycling out on time. So I take this stuff in fitfully and imperfectly.
How do the kids react to all of this?
You know, one of the wise people I've talked to about parenting, Sylvia Boorstein, pointed something out that, you know, our children actually aren't listening to what we say. I mean, of course, they're listening to what we say. If we say, you've got to take the trash out or you won't get your allowance. But they are always, always watching us. Mm-hmm. And I think I've understood somehow. I mean, that actually is a sobering thought. But I think I've always understood, like, I kind of talk about my work, but I also understand that that these ideas and these questions that I work with in my show are things that they will work with in their lives at their own pace. And I think, you know, for them, and you may have this as well, I think children, if you have kind of a public life, it's really important for children to hang on to the private person. Mm-hmm. Like they're, you know, in some ways they're not that interested and they're kind of resistant to this Krista Tippett person who's not their mother.
Yeah. How old are your kids?
Well, see, now they're 22 and 17.
Uh-huh.
So it's just my son home and he's getting ready to go away next year. So I've got a big life passage.
So they're at a stage now where they're suddenly realizing how smart mom really is.
Well, actually, I will say I never have asked them to read or listen. Every once in a while I'll say, you know, there's this interview I did, or maybe I'll like turn it on. But they have to come to these ideas themselves. But my daughter did read this book. And there's some things I talk about myself in there and even about my marriage to her dad. Mm-hmm. In a way that I hadn't talked. So she actually, at 22, did find it. I think for the first time, she could find it interesting in kind of an objective way.
Yeah. On page 136 of your book, I saw a line that took me a little bit by surprise. And you may not want to talk about this, and tell me if you don't.
Okay.
But you talk about being estranged from your father.
Hmm. Yeah.
Is that still going on?
That is still going on,
yes.
And so one of the things that was hard about writing this book was that I actually had to hold myself to what I asked people to do with me, which is to walk the line between what they know and who they are and these big ideas and then human experience. And there's this there's this darkness and sadness in my, the origins of my life, and so many of us have our version of that. But it was actually kind of a gift to me that I got to figure out how it fits into all of this and how it's part of me. And yes, it is, and it's a sadness in my life that I'm estranged from my father.
Yeah, well, I won't pursue that, but I, mm-hmm. you know, I have a family situation that's not dissimilar to that, and mm-hmm. That's why I guess it struck me in the way that it did. Why did you write this book? What made you, what compelled you to write this book?
I think I'd actually say the answer to that evolved at different points in the writing. I would have a different answer. I originally had the idea and kind of signed the contract years and years ago, because people were always asking me this question. So you have these conversations with wise people. What are the recurring themes? What are the recurring qualities in these lives of wisdom and grace? And I thought, I thought this might be more a book of transcripts. Mm-hmm. And that would have been much easier.
Sure.
And then that's not really what the publishers wanted. And then it's not really what I had time to write. But whenever I did think about it and write about it, it was kind of good for me to pull together what I was learning. But I think you'll understand this too. I'm not usually the person, like, I'm present in an interview, but I'm not talking about myself. Mm. I may be reacting and saying something personal as part of the conversation, but I had to kind of develop a new practice of, I am the connective tissue between these different conversations, right? Because these conversations are in conversation in my head. But to actually bring that out and to be in the mix was challenging. So I think in the end I finished it because it had become really important for me to do. I mean, it was a way of working with this stuff I've been doing for 12 years. That felt meaningful for me personally, as well as I felt meaningful for the project. Like, I'm not sure what that means, but mm-hmm. I feel that it is the right thing.
What do you want folks to take away from it?
I feel very grateful to have kind of walked into this work. And I think what I've tried to do and been able to do a little bit is condense some big ideas and a lot of complexity and bring a lot of voices in. Writing is like, I think in a conversation, it happens that we, in this communion, put words around things we didn't know we could say or we didn't know we thought. And mm-hmm. that's what happens in writing too. I hope it will be useful for people. I hope it'll be practically useful.
Well, you mentioned words, and that is that's the book, really. I'm looking at my notes here, and what was it I was trying to find here? You call these words that you have selected the raw materials of life,
yes.
The five raw materials of life.
Yes.
Words being one, body or flesh being mm-hmm. another, love, faith, and hope being the remaining of the five.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I could think of a lot of other words that I might have put in that list. Why? Just
yes.
Give me the Cliff Notes version of why these
yeah.
five.
Well, I think it's connected to the last question. I started out also with a longer list of yeah. words. And as it got through, I realized that what I hope people will take from it, and I realized what I've learned is, wisdom is not for the wise sages of history. Wisdom is something that is accessible to all of us. And it emerges through the raw materials of our lives. And I found that, the words we speak, which we do so much all through the day, the power of that, the bodies we inhabit, the physicality of our experience, our physical relationship with the world around us, love, which I want to de-romanticize. I hear this word surfacing as a longing. It is an elemental experience that calls forth the best in us, faith and hope, which is, I think, a muscle we can exercise.
Right.
These are ordinary elements of experience, and through these, wisdom emerges.
You mentioned love, and the word, yeah. My note here says that, as you put it in the book, it is the most watered-down word in the English language.
Yes.
And that means?
Well, you know, I love this weather, I love your dress, I fall in love, I fall out of love. Other languages have a bigger vocabulary for love, you know, philia, the love of friendship, you know, eros is, I think, or romantic love is what we're talking about, I'd say, you know, 95% of the time. I think of love as, I would like for us to kind of hold the question of love, what could love be, as something robust and muscular and practical about care for each other. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we are understanding that, you know, alongside our structures and our policies and whatever laws we pass, this care that we need to have for each other, this belonging that we have to each other in cities and communities, across boundaries, you know, our strangers who are our neighbors. I do want to call that love, but I think we have to learn how to practice it, how to exercise it, so that it then can ennoble the structures we create.
And mean something.
And mean something, yeah.
Let's take a couple of calls, if you don't mind. We have some folks who want to get in the conversation with Krista Tippett, so let's start that process. We'll bring in Benjamin, who's calling from Edwardsville first. Benjamin, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Don and Krista. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question, but listening on the phone here, I wanted to chime in about this idea of love is more robust. I work in a dome designed by Buckminster Fuller on the SIUE campus, and he said about love, love is metaphysical gravity, which is an interesting
idea. That's great,
You know, as gravity as a thing that draws us together and draws us to the planet, and love draws us together. It's interesting. But my question is, in all the thinking that you've done about spirituality and religion in contemporary times, do you ever see a need for an updating of some of these ancient versions of mythologies and things that might incorporate scientific discovery and accommodate for everything we know now, but build on the past?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm interested in living tradition. And I think... and I write in the book about, you know, my observation that a lot of what is being analyzed as people fleeing religion, you know, the phenomenon of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, people who say on opinion polls that they are not affiliated, don't have a religious tradition. I experience in that sphere of our society a lot of actual spiritual searching, theological curiosity, and ethical passion that I think are calling our traditions back to their own heart. And our religious traditions, like every institution, like every human institution in the 21st century, are being turned inside out by technology. The structures we have don't make sense for who we are now and how we live now. So there are always transformations. And I actually think, interestingly, that the non-religious among us, what scientists are learning, that this absolutely will actually evolve faith in our time.
Benjamin, thank you so much for the call. We'll try Jerry now, calling from O'Fallon, Missouri. Jerry, good to have you with us. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. I just want to say, first of all, your show is one of those marvelous gateways that every time I listen, it brings up 12 more questions and directions to look into. And it's just
you.
A really wonderful thing. I have a really simple question, and that is there any hope? No, seriously. I see the biggest problem with people becoming enlightened is that they choose not to see or not to seek. And unfortunately, to kind of dovetail on what you just said, religion in many ways, as it is practiced, not in theory, tends to try, I think, in many ways to move people away from seeking and instead accept the answers that they would like to give. And that's always been my most frustrating component whenever you try to have a discussion about this nature of things like this, that people just have a tendency to shun it because it's different and it's new. Anyway, thank you very much for all you do.
Thank you so much. Yeah, absolutely. I find seeking to be so alive and to be so alive inside traditions. And you know, one of the things I experience in all the conversations I have with scientists is this great delight in mystery and this real comfort in knowing that there are things you don't know. And, you know, it being joyful about that and taking that on as an adventure. And I actually think that that spirit of inquiry is at the orthodox core heart of our big great traditions. And, you know, and as I say, I think influences even from outside the traditions and this age that we live in, which is just so defined by these vast open questions, I think this is going to have to open our traditions back up to more joyfully inhabiting mystery and, you know, the adventure of that and enjoying that as well.
We have less than a minute left. You differentiate between hope, one of your five words, mm-hmm. and optimism.
Yes.
What is the difference in your mind?
I feel like optimism and is like wishful thinking. And for me, hope is reality-based. Like hope works with reality. but it works with the fullness of reality. It is open-eyed, and it is also looking at what is good and right and true that is happening and factoring that in also to factoring in imagination and a sense of possibility and a sense of what you are willing to work for in terms of what is real.
Just a nibble of the food for thought that is present in the book Becoming Wise, An Inquiry into the Mystery and Art of Living by Krista Tippett. So nice to have you with us. I'll let folks know that you'll be at the Ethical Society tonight at 7 o'clock. We'll do another interview at that time, but you're sold out. So folks are going to have to deal with what they've heard here who can't be there tonight.
So happy to be on St. Louis Public Radio.
We're happy to have you, Krista Tippett. Thank you so much. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is produced by Mary Edwards, Alex Hoyer, and Kelly Moffitt, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr, Valita Brown, and Spencer Reed. Executive producers Robert Peterson. Arts and culture programming on St. Louis On the Air, funded in part by the Arts and Education Council of Greater St. Louis, the Regional Arts Commission, and the Missouri Arts Council Estate Agency. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.